you're going to find struggles no matter what you do. So you just got to choose which ones you want. And I struggled having a full-time job because the whole time I was there, I was just like, I want to be working for myself. But now I'm working for myself and I'm like, I don't know, kind of sounds nice to work for someone, you know? And it's not like you're technically working for yourself. You know, I work for clients. It's just like, I make the rules. Maybe that's it. Maybe I have a problem with someone else telling me what the rules are. And maybe that's like the catalyst of why I do this. But we'll see. When I put the feelers out for a little 9-to-5s here and there.
This is Students of Design, a graphic design podcast for students, young professionals, or anyone interested in the design industry. My name is Joseph Israel Raul Bullard, and I'm an independent designer based in Colorado. Today's guest is Brooks Engel, aka Zesty Cyclops, aka the skate park gremlin, or the Dole Whip top dog, but you probably know him as Nowhereland. He's a SoCal-born designer and illustrator based in Denver, and he's been running his design shop, Nowhereland, for close to a decade. You'll recognize his work for its bold colors and its stylized landscapes, which often transform into the shapes of wildlife. And Brooks is on a mission to help you go nowhere, along with his friends Maggie and the Ferocious Beast. Once upon a time, Brooks was headed for the major leagues, but left that life behind. But one of his goals for 2025 is to bench 315 pounds. Tick tock. Brooks is also a huge Dave Quiggle fan. His favorite band is Atmosphere. There's some crossover there. And one of his favorite childhood memories is going to Newport Beach because there was a giant fake well that doubled as a slide. Anyway, Brooks, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I don't know how you know most of that stuff. So clearly I'm more prevalent on the internet than I was aware of.
Top dog, man.
That was in the pocket too. You didn't even mention any of that before we started recording. That's pretty crazy.
Oh yeah. I couldn't reveal any of the things I was going to say before we started because I want to get that reaction out of you.
Those are some deep cuts.
Yeah, I like the skate park gremlin. I made that one up, but I like that.
That's a good one. The Zesty Cyclops is the deepest of the cuts.
That is deep, yeah. All right, Brooks, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and the kind of work that you're doing?
Like you said, I'm a illustrator artist from Denver, primarily working in the apparel industry. That's where I got my interest and my love for design. I was making merch. One of my first jobs out of college was at an apparel company. And I kind of just gone from there. I really gravitated towards that. I skipped the traditional like ad agency part of design. Never really interested me. And I think that working in the merchandise world tailored my art style and how I work and who I am 10 years later. And I did want to go to the major leagues to play baseball at a time. So I wasn't like the typical kid that grew up drawing all the time. Baseball was a heavy part of my life up until I was like 19, 20. But then hard switched into drawing and art after that. Yeah, that's about it. Not really anything else too interesting.
For a little bit of context, I should mention that we met for the first time earlier this year in Austin at Crop Conference. And I drove from Colorado up to Austin, so I had my vehicle throughout the conference. I'm very curious if you remember the lift I gave you with a few other people. Do you remember anything about that ride?
Oh, vividly remember. First of all, I was like, this is the nicest dude I've ever met. Like, I just met you 10 minutes ago and you're already like offering me rides. Like, I was just going to walk or grab an Uber or whatever. And you're like, nah, dude, just hop in. You know, you just met me. And I was like, okay, let's just roll with it. This is the point of me being out here is to meet people and like hang out. So, you know, you took me to lunch and then we promptly almost got into a little fender bender. And your reaction and the other person's reaction were like the calmest, almost accident. No one yelled. The dude said, sorry. You're like, all good, man. And I was like, who am I with right now? Like, this man is calm under pressure. Like, and then obviously we went to lunch and had a nice time. But yeah, that was a funny little ride.
Yeah, I was curious if you remember that almost accident that happened. And like that exchange was pretty bizarre. I even thought it was pretty bizarre. Nick and Andre were in the vehicle too. And they had sort of the same reaction because they're also from California. And they're like, what the fuck is even going on right now? This is like the Twilight Zone.
That is normally just an all out yelling at each other like, you almost hit me, all, you know, and that none of that happened. I was like, okay, well, I feel like if I was driving, I would have been like, this idiot cut me off and all this, but none of that happened.
It could have easily gone in the opposite direction immediately. You know, like just to tone the approach, either party, like if one of you comes in hot, game over.
Yeah.
Because you're going to react and then, you know, all of a sudden you're going back and forth. But that was really interesting. And when I go back to Austin, it's exaggerated when I go back to Austin for crop. But because I'm from Austin, I get in like host mode. So that day, I was like, who can I help? Who can I give a ride? I know everybody's going to be taking Lyft and Uber or walking. So how many people can I fit in my Bronco and let's roll so that we can save time and people can save money? So I was 100% in like, I'm hosting.
Well, you got me. Not only did you drive me to lunch, but you drove me to my hotel so I could stop there and drop my stuff off real quick. You made a detour for me. And I was like, all right, man, just the nicest, most generous, like very simple task. But like most people are like, okay, well, like we'll just meet you there kind of thing. And you're like, no, get in the car. I'll take you to the hotel where you're going to lunch. And, you know, that's just probably speaks to who you are as a person, but also like what that event is about and being in Austin doing that stuff is that's kind of the point of it.
Yeah, 1,000%, man. That is the energy, the vibe, the positivity. But I'm glad you took me up on the offer because I sort of had to convince you to do it, especially when we got to dropping you off at your hotel part. But then we had an awesome lunch and had Via 313, and that shit is amazing for anyone who's been to Crop and had Via 313 before or from Austin. But anyone familiar with your artwork knows that apparel design is a big part of what you do. And I think you've probably created more t-shirt designs than anyone I've ever met. And I've followed your Instagram account for a while, but I didn't truly understand the volume of work you produce until I took a closer look before this interview. Dude, and it's all good. I've always been really impressed by your illustrations and your use of color, which I might ask you about later. But here's a question. What do you think you don't do so well?
That's easy for me to answer. There's a few things that I struggle with even a decade into doing this is if we're going to talk about design illustration specifically, like I'm not a technical designer. I don't have this wealth of knowledge of, like as far as the programs or the software that I use. I'm like bare bones. I use a brush tool in Photoshop. I use a pen tool in Illustrator. Beyond that, I just never really put in the effort to learn all like the little cool tricks and like to really use the software to its fullest ability, which is I would advise you to do that. But I think you mentioning about like the amount of work I do, it just all comes from like I learned how I work and I've just stuck with that. I've never gone out of my way to change how I do it, even though it might be easier because I'm like, if I'm going to sit down on my computer for 3 hours, do I waste 3 hours trying to learn something new or do I just get in, do what I always do and finish a design at the end of 3 hours? So I think being a little bit stubborn and not like pushing myself to like learn new tools or like, you know, mess around with Procreate or any other software like Photoshop, Illustrator has been the same exact. I draw the same way. You know, I work in the program the same way I always have for the last 10 years. And to a fault, I just don't have the time I think I could dedicate to learning new stuff. Life-wise, where I don't do well, or I guess like business-wise, I'm a terrible business person. I don't have contracts. I don't like have a very professional persona. I'm like a very casual person. So it's like who I deal with, regardless of who you are, that's just who I am kind of thing. Like I'm not going to edit myself if I have like a big client that's like this corporate entity. I work in a very plain way and that's how I like it. So if like you don't want to do that, that's fine. Then we're just not compatible kind of thing. And I don't think that's a good business practice, but it's just like, I do this because I like to draw. Everything that comes outside of that, the business, the finding clients, working with people, emails, all that stuff is not what I want to do. So I don't do well at it. That's not a good thing to do. This is not advice. This is maybe advice of what not to do. So I think those are two of my biggest, like, I wish I could change, but I'm just too stubborn to change.
Well, I think all that's fair because I don't think anyone can argue with the fact that you are efficient because the amount of output, you can see it on Instagram. There's proof on social media of how much work you're cranking out. So even though it's not a very refined business approach, you're still getting shit done and you're still cranking out work and you still have clients coming through the door. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to not want to change that if you don't feel like it needs to be changed. But I do think what you said about this being advice of what not to do, I think this is good advice of what not to do for people out there up and coming, or even, you know, if you're trying to make the transition from a full-time role in the industry to working for yourself full-time. The biggest one that stood out was the no contract. That was surprising to hear.
I think if I could go back in time and like start doing that, I recommend doing that. because I've been burned a few times, but I just, when a contract gets involved, it becomes like less fun for me. And it's kind of a childish way to look at this because, you know, I got to look at business first. Although I am drawing pictures for a living, like I am doing this as my living. So I need to like take it seriously, but also like I'm drawing pictures. So it's not serious and I am not a serious person. So as soon as like the contract gets involved and all this stuff, it's like, all right, now we're not having fun anymore. And I just don't want to do it. And that's just like a personal flaw. But I do think it helps speed up the process of a lot of stuff.
Sure.
You know, like I'm drawing t-shirts. So it's like, we're just banging them out as quick as I can, but also trying to like make sure each person gets like dedicated time to their project. And like, that's how I can keep cost down as far as like what I'm going to charge them.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to start adding in like all these meetings and all these like discovery calls, all that stuff, you know, that's my time. So that brings the price of what I'm going to charge you up. But if we can cut down all that, keep it to emails, keep it easy, keep it moving quick, then I'm going to charge you less, but it's also going to take me less time. So I think it's like a little bit of a win-win. Some people don't like the casualness of that, but I didn't say thank you when you complimented me on my amount of work. I appreciate that. And I don't know if it's the most t-shirts anyone's ever made, but I've definitely drawn a lot.
Well, for me, it's the most I've seen, man. When I dug through your Instagram account, I was like, holy shit, there's probably three times more than the amount I thought was on there.
I'm only posting the good ones.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah. We even
got not good ones.
For sure. Well, I think there's something to be said for the success you've had despite not being completely buttoned up as a business person. You know, it's clearly working. I think if it wasn't working, then you would probably feel more inclined to make some kind of adjustment or, you know, maybe take a business class or just kind of reach out to people who have that shit kind of squared away. But I love that you're open about something as simple as not having contracts in place. And I think it really helps that you work with a lot of the same people. You have like repeat clients. So for those clients, you don't always need to have, you know, a 13-page agreement in place because there's a lot of trust that you've built with that client and your relationship is solid. So, you know, there's some give and take here and there, but I want to go back to 2016, which is when you started Nowhere Land and began working independently. For the next 2 years, you worked with local clothing brands, breweries, coffee shops, and everything in between, all while you still had a full-time day job at a place called The Duck Company. However, you left that job in 2018 and you and your fiance packed up your RV and moved to California. Then you lived out of that RV for the following year. So I would love to know, what was it like working for yourself full-time out of an RV?
It was so much fun, but also just like a crazy thing to do. It was just the right time in our lives. Like I was a few years into my design career, like post-college, probably like 4-ish years working in the apparel world. I worked for the Duck Company, was like a resort apparel company that, you know, anytime you go to a little like tourist town and their t-shirt shop there, like that's what they did. I think that's where I learned like the speed of creating t-shirts because it was like, we've got 1 month to create a catalog that needs like 300 designs in it. And it was like me and 6 other artists and you had to just come up with stuff. Their game plan was just quantity. They need every option under the sun. That helped me learn this speed thing. But while doing that, my wife was a nurse and she had an opportunity to be a travel nurse at the time was like a big thing where, you know, you'd take a contract for a few months at a hospital and they would hire this, like basically just needed an employee for a short amount of time. So that was the catalyst for me to just quit my job. I was freelancing, but it was never like enough freelance to really make me feel comfortable to quit. But that was like the pivot point of we were going to do that to keep the cost low. We were going to live in this RV, pack up all of our stuff in there and just like drive around and fulfill these like nursing contracts that she had. So we basically did California. We were in Sacramento for a big chunk of it and then worked our way down to Southern California, just outside of LA. And it couldn't have been a better mesh of where I was at. I wanted to work for myself. I think I was like 25 at the time. And I'm going to quit my job. We're going to hop in this RV and we're just going to do it. We were in a new city. I didn't have friends. She was working. I didn't have anything to do but sit in front of my computer and just work. If I didn't do that, I don't think I'd be as successful as a freelance artist because I had the luxury of being able to just do nothing but focus on that. And it was just like day and night, I was just doing as much work as physically possible, almost to a detriment now because some of the clients that I had at that time were so used to how fast I was working that now that I have kids now, all this stuff, So my timelines are way different. I'm not working at till 4 a.m. anymore. Instead of one day to take me to do a design, it's taking me a couple weeks to finish projects. And it was just a wild time. And I had so much growth in that year to go from basically square one to like full-fledged freelance business. And I think that was like truly the catalyst of where I'm at now. And it was a good time. And we were on the beach, so can't complain.
I'm pretty sure Starlink wasn't around in 2016. So how did you access the internet when you needed it?
So most of the time we would lodge at like an RV park. So they have like long-term stays where you could stay for months at a time. But then when we were actually traveling, I think it was like Comcast or Xfinity or like Verizon, they have like mobile hotspot kind of thing. So you'd like work on the road. That was never a huge issue because we were pretty like, we'd travel. And then once we got to the destination, we would stay there. And then we towed a car behind the RV. So when we need to drive around, we'd drive the car and the RV would like stay where it was at. So we met some interesting ass people there, like people that live in RV full time. And it was crazy. You know, I basically like showered in a 24-hour fitness for a whole year. I mean, there was a shower in the RV, but it was very small.
Mm-hmm.
So I just go to the gym and I would shower there. So I was like for a whole year, just using community shower, which was just a wild time, but it was fun.
I imagine that sounds completely foreign to a lot of people to like shower at the gym for an entire year, but it's a lot of people's dream where we live in Colorado. A lot of people are really striving to reach that life where they can be nomads or digital nomads and they can work on the road outside of their decked out van or an RV, have something like Starlink or some other kind of hotspot, and then work outdoors, still be able to do your day job or be an independent designer or whatever you do. That's a lot of people's dreams. So it's really cool that you had a chance to do that, even, you know, just for a year.
Yeah, I mean, if you have the means to do it or it works with what you got going on in your life, man, just do it. I know it's easy to say it like that and there's a lot more nuance to it, but it just gives you the opportunity to like strip back everything that you're doing and like really just focus on that one thing. I don't think I would do it now, but at that moment in our lives, it was like couldn't have been a more perfect catalyst to being able to just focus on me and what I was doing. And my wife was, you know, she worked at night for 3 or 4 days in a row. I wouldn't see her. She would just work at night and then she'd sleep during the day. We were kind of just focused on our work at that point. And then we'd take some time to like, we'd go to national parks and stuff and kind of adventure here and there. But it was a blast. I think we would have continued to do it longer, but we had two cats with us and they just weren't getting along and they were like miserable. So we kind of ended it short. But I mean, then COVID happened like 6 months later. So we're kind of glad that we ended it.
Oh, damn.
Because COVID dropped like right after that, kind of shut down everything. So we would have been alone, not being able to do anything in a different state than everyone we know. And so we kind of coincidentally like came back right before that and moved back into a little town or like duplex. So it was a good time.
It's fascinating. You sort of covered this already, but while you were at the Duck Company, you were designing apparel for resorts and vacation destinations. And it seems like you really expanded your skill set and settled into how to design for the retail world. But while you were still working there, you had this thought, damn, I'm going to be here forever. This is it. Why did you think that? And why didn't you stay there forever?
I noticed as soon as I started working there, there was now, if we're going to put a title to it, which I got a lot of hot takes about the design industry. This is one of them. I think titles for your jobs are all just made up and it's all bullshit. But at the, you know, you would call this person a creative director for whatever reason. Me and him had the same job. You know, I started day one. I was an illustrator on the team. He had been there for 15 years. He was still just an illustrator on the team and very talented person. I learned a lot from him. He was very comfortable in that position, which is fine. Like there's no, I'm not trying to say that that's not okay. I'm just saying that if I'm looking 15 years into the future and I'm at the same exact position, I'm sure he made more money than I did, but on paper, we had the same position. And I was like, all right, well, I know for a fact that this isn't like a long game here, but it was very educational for me. I wanted to absorb the experience while knowing that this is like a stepping stone. I'm not going to be 15 years down the road doing the same thing. And I think it's okay to know where you want to go, but understand that you kind of have to take some different steps along the way to get there. And this was just one of those like detours where I was there for a couple of years while working on side freelance, getting better at design, getting better at merchandise. And that, again, is a pivotal part in me knowing how to do what I know how to do now. If I didn't work those jobs, I wouldn't be able to do this. You need to do those types of things early on to get to wherever your career you want to go. I've had a very clear vision from early on of, I know I want to work for myself. How do I get to that point? And I just got lucky a little bit that it only took me 4.5 years-ish to get there. And I think that can be different for many people, but those things just showed it to me. And I don't know how to say this in the right way, but I watch what people do almost in a bad way. I'm like so in tune to like how everyone is like moving throughout the world. Sometimes it's all good. Oh, I admire that person. I want to try to do what they're doing. But then it's the opposite of, oh, I don't like what that person is doing. So how can I do the opposite? But then it's like goes down this weird rabbit hole of paying attention too much to what everyone else is doing. But I was doing that to this guy that was like 15 years into his career doing the same thing. And I was like, this feels weird to me and I don't like it. So I'm going to avoid that. And so far, so good.
Now I know why you have a lot of hot takes for the industry. Watching it really closely, figuring out what you don't like, what you don't want to do, what you want to be the opposite of. You reminded me of some thoughts I had before I started working at Dell. I knew it was going to be, like you said, it was going to be a stepping stone job. I knew I wasn't going to stay there forever. I think the biggest difference is that there was a lot of room for growth at Dell, but it just was never going to be the greatest fit for me. And I knew that before I went there and worked there for 2.5 years before I decided to leave. But I had similar thoughts. And I know I'm going to learn a lot working here. Bonus that it was a super stable salary while I was there so I could stack some money. But at the end of the day, my time had kind of run out and then I wanted to move on and do something different. And then went and started teaching and things like that. But I want to come back to working independently. I learned that when you went out on your own full time, you struggled with something that a lot of us struggle with, which is maintaining a list of clients and active projects. And of course, that's understandable and highly relatable. So I want to read something you said in 2020. You said, "I would rather struggle a little to make my own business than to do it for someone else. Overall, there are a lot more positives than negatives." So what do you think now, 5 years later? Do you still feel that way in 2025?
I think the like artist in me agrees with that sentiment. If you want to view it as some like punk rock DIY work for yourself, it all sounds really cool and glamorous. And it is at times. But I think having a family and kids, that kind of changes things. I still do it, obviously, but it's just different. And sometimes a little 9-to-5 stable job sounds cool, sounds fun. You're going to find struggles no matter what you do. So you just got to choose which ones you want. And I struggled having a full-time job because the whole time I was there, I was just like, I want to be working for myself. But now I'm working for myself and I'm like, I don't know, kind of sounds nice to work for someone, you know? And it's not like you're technically working for yourself. You know, I work for clients. It's just like, I make the rules. Maybe that's it. Maybe I have a problem with someone else telling me what the rules are. And maybe that's like the catalyst of why I do this. But we'll see. I put the feelers out for a little 9-to-5s here and there.
Word. Well, I like the push-pull. While you're working a full-time job, you're like, screw this. I want to be working independently. And then now that you work independently for 10 years, there are moments where you think that it wouldn't be so bad to have, you know, that stable gig and sort of maybe work with people again, work on a team, have a little bit more structure, but also not be the person that has to make all the rules. I think there's a lot of stress that comes, there's a lot of baggage that comes along with that. And there's a lot of pressure from being the person that has to call all the shots and call them right or forecast correctly, or even just run a business all by yourself. So there's a lot of pressure there. It's interesting to hear you phase between the two, because I think that's something that we can all relate to because of the way our lives change and the way we get wiser as we get older, we can change the way we feel about things. So it's cool to listen to that push-pull. Something else I noticed while scrolling through your Instagram feed and on your YouTube channel is that you set goals for yourself. Can you explain what the phrase short steps, long vision means to you?
You're an internet sleuth. I see you. I'm also an internet sleuth. I'd be looking at stuff. The phrase short steps, long vision. So I don't think this person is the originator of this, but the first place I heard it was on Instagram, and it was said by none other than Mr. Worldwide Pitbull, the singer, rapper extraordinaire. I don't know why. There's just a clip of him saying this, and he explained this kind of thought process that I've had for a long time, but never really like put it into such a short phrase, four words that explain basically who I am and what I do as a person. I think having a goal is important, but I don't think it's got to be this like tightly wound thing, which would be the long vision, this pie in the sky, caviar dreams, put a flagpole like 10 miles out. And at the time when I was younger, my flagpole was like work for myself. And I'm throwing that thing way out into the future. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get there. And I'm not focused on that part. I'm not like, okay, in the next 3 years, I need to do X, Y, Z. It's just existing. You know, in the back of my mind, it's there. Now, obviously, if we want to like be real, we have to like take steps towards that long vision. And that would be the short step part. All right, there's this pole 10 miles out, but what's step one towards that pole? Because there's going to be 1,000 steps between now and there, but I'm just going to focus on the first step. And it could be as simple as, let's just say I have dreams of other things now. I have different goals now, and I'm in that process of what's step one? It could be easy as, let's figure out a name for a business. Okay, let's start brainstorming. That could be a step. That's not going to get you to work for yourself, but it is putting you in the direction. I've just always done that. Make a random goal, write it down, don't look at it, and just start taking steps that feel like it's in the right direction. And some might not be. Some might be sideways or backwards. But as long as like there's this persistent pursuit is kind of the idea behind it all, is like, I don't think you have to have such a like gnarly, like if I don't achieve this in the next 2 years, then I've failed, because that's not the point of it. The point of it is all these little mini goals along the way of like, okay, I started freelancing and then I got more clients and then I started like trying to sell merch and I went to vendor shows and I met more people there and then I started building a client roster. All those little steps along the way have their own little tiny steps within them. And I just think it's this like pursuit of this end goal to the point sometimes when you get to the end goal, which I did, you're like, oh shit. Well, while I was along that way, I threw out a different flagpole that's another 10 miles in the future. So once I reached this one that was my original goal, oh shit, I'm back to step one again. I don't know. It's just a way for me to like verbalize having this like continual ambition towards something. I think things have changed now. It seems like I was like this weird hardcore like rise and grind kind of person, which I'm not. I hate that. You can have a goal and be like casual about it. And I think that's the point of it. And to be like, say some shit, bench 315 pounds. That's a random thing, random goal. I could be 5 years away from that. I could be 1 year away from that. That has nothing to do with design, but I still like put that goal in my mind because I want to like take steps towards that. Step one could be get a gym membership. I'm like, all right, check that off. All right. And then step two is actually go to the gym. Those little incremental things eventually lead to that long vision.
I like it. I think it's great advice. It's good advice to follow, and setting reachable goals, even if they're part of a bigger, longer vision, just setting reachable milestones can be a game changer because you feel like you're making progress. I said this in a previous episode, but you give yourself the ability to check off boxes to say, hey, I accomplished that. I did that. I can feel good about this small victory because it's putting me on the path to reaching this bigger, longer goal. And I really like that you mentioned the word casual when you were talking about having goals. Like, you can have a goal and be casual about it. And I wanted to add on to that because I think you can have a goal and be casual about it and still reach that goal. You don't have to wake up at 3 a.m. and grind until 3 p.m., sleep for an hour, and then do the same thing over. You don't have to do that to reach these goals, especially if you're reaching it step by step and breaking it down into smaller pieces so that it feels like it's something that you can actually accomplish in like a reasonable amount of time. Even if it is 5 years, you're hitting those milestones. And I think that it's just great for mental health, keeping you sane and keeping you focused and helping you feel like you are making progress. And I think that's a big deal.
That was almost a better way to say it, with the small victories, I think is what I was getting at, is that it's a daunting task to go from zero to write down, I want to work for myself. That's a very ambiguous statement because that can mean a lot of things. If all you write down on your, I write everything down in a notebook, writing that down at the top of a page with no list of things to do underneath, it might take you 10 years to check that box off. Or you could write down 10 tasks that you need to do in the next 10 weeks to point yourself in that right direction. And you can check one of those boxes off, or even 10 tasks today. Like you said, it's just better for your mental health to give yourself some tasks that you can complete today and that eventually you can check off the big box at the top. But if you only write down the big box, you're going to be staring at that for a long time and never going to be able to check it off. So it's like, do yourself a favor, set smaller goals that eventually lead to the big goal.
Definitely. Obviously, going out on your own to build a business will be challenging. You could have the perfect setup, the perfect skill set, and the perfect clients, and you're still going to experience ups and downs and find something to complain about. So when you find yourself complaining about working independently, what perspective or mindset helps you step back and appreciate the freedom that working for yourself offers?
I like this question a lot. I pop off from time to time. I have my own qualms with the design industry. I think it's because I am so deeply a part of it, passionate about it, that I think I criticize it harshly because I care about it. And it's mostly towards other people that maybe do things differently than I would, and I disagree, whatever. And sometimes I try to keep those things to myself because I'm like, what's the benefit of me complaining about this stuff? And everyone's going to have struggles no matter how cushy your life or your job is. And there's always something that could be better, but there's always something that could be worse. In a way, maybe you compare yourself and you're looking up. You compare yourself to people that you admire, or maybe you compare yourself to people that have something that you want, and that kind of can weigh on you. And I complain about dumb stuff because at the end of the day, I'm drawing pictures. What I'm doing is insignificant to the world at large, but it's what I've chosen to do with my existence here. I think the easiest way to put in perspective is things could be way worse. You know, I could work construction on the side of the road. I have no other skills in life. So it's either art or what am I doing? Chopping trees? I don't know what the option is, but it's whatever option B is way worse than what I'm doing now. Do I want to do that? When I drive down the road and I see dudes out there in 90 degree weather, working on a building, and I'm like, that seems horrible. Obviously a necessary part of the world we live in, but I don't want to do that. Maybe I should shut up and just go back to doing my shit. And it can go even further than it doesn't have to be work related, just be life related. I don't know how dark you want to get to this question, but people live in war zones and shit. People live in poverty. People live in third world countries. People in the country we live in don't have drinkable water. That's all shit that I don't have to worry about. Someone told me that they didn't like my picture that I drew. That's fucking nothing. You know, it just makes you feel like your problems are insignificant, which they're not. I mean, you're allowed to have issues. You're allowed to have struggles. But to a certain extent, you got to try to rein it back and be like, I'm doing pretty good. I'm living in a house. I've got air conditioning. That in itself doesn't have to do with the design. Doesn't have anything to do with work. But that's just a thing I don't even have to worry about. So the fact that there are people existing that have to worry about that shit and also have a job and also try to exist while not even getting basic needs to life met. I know this is probably a little more existential answer than what you were looking for, but there is plenty of horrible shit going on in the world that me complaining about art or design seems dumb. But then on the other hand, I be complaining about art and design often. So clearly I'm not taking my own advice.
It's all about finding that balance, man. I think it's healthy to complain about things like that. It's healthy to have an opinion. It's healthy to have an opinion that is different than others. I think it's healthy to criticize the industry because of the reason you stated. It's an industry you really care about. And I think the best people to criticize the industry are the people that are a part and work in that industry. But you also use the word insignificant, which I like because I'm a big Carl Sagan fan and the idea of the pale blue dot. So that's how I sort of set my perspective back in place, is to just look at things on a cosmic timeline. Yeah, you using the word insignificant, man, we are such little morsels, specks of dust that will mostly be forgotten in the cosmic timeline that it doesn't even matter. We just need to make the best of our lives and do the best we can while we're alive on the earth, because it is such a small moment and small blip in the universe.
I always think about it like a big horror movie guy. So anytime you see zombie apocalypse, I think about because you always wonder, what did those people do when they realized before the zombie apocalypse? You're like, well, I was an artist. Doesn't mean shit in a zombie apocalypse. So if your job title in your real life wouldn't matter if the world ended, then what you're doing doesn't really matter per se. Are you a nurse or a doctor or a scientist? Or that's all important shit. I don't know how to say that without being rude. So just try to have some fucking fun and like don't take it too seriously. But also maybe do take it seriously so you can like make money and live.
Right. Well, I'd like to talk more specifically about your work. But before we do that, I want to ask you about baseball, because baseball was your life until 19, 20 years old. How did the shift away from pursuing pro baseball open the door to art and design for you?
Growing up, my dad played high-level baseball. And I guess let me rephrase that. He played high-level baseball before I was born. But growing up, that was like a big part of his life. So he wanted it to be a big part of my life. And he played AAA baseball for a while. And then like for a little bit, he played professional for like a season, basically. So, you know, admiring, looking up to my father, I wanted to like do the same thing. And like every young kid that plays sports, you always think that you're going to go pro. Obviously, that's not realistic. So I had a bit of a weird accident in high school and I lost the vision in one of my eyes. And that kind of like derailed my potential at playing baseball. So I just was like, what other things am I interested in? And I had a really cool art teacher in high school. Shout out to Miss Ray. She's incredible. She fostered any ideas that you had. If you showed an interest in art, she was like, all right, let's go. Like, where do you want to take this? If you didn't care about it, like, you know, everyone takes an art high school class and most people are like, whatever, it's nonsense. So she was like, I'll meet you wherever you're at. If you're interested, cool, I'll go with you. If you don't care, then we'll just leave it at this is a high school art class. But like I showed interest in it post trying to play baseball. And I was like just trying to find something. And she explained to me like what graphic design was and like what that could be. And whatever she saw in me that I had like a mild talent or at least mild interest, she was like, push me towards that. Because she knew I played baseball, like her husband like worked in the sports world. She kind of knew like what had happened. And like we were post that accident. I was a senior, like junior or senior, and she was just like trying to help me out a little bit. I mean, it really changed what I thought I was going to do or what I wanted to do. And, you know, she gave me a list of like colleges that to do like graphic design and stuff. So I ended up going to college for design and kind of went that direction. And baseball ended up being a thing of the past and not as a bad thing, just as like a difference in interest. So now I put all my effort towards that. So I put like the same amount of effort that I put into being better at baseball, practicing. Like I just look at it from that perspective of like talent, although some people have talent, everything that we know how to do is all just from practice and through learning and doing it over and over again. I've just implemented that same idea from team sports to like a career in art. You know, I still play old man softball every Thursday night. I get out there on the bases, but it's more just for fun now. So it's an interesting transition.
Practice. What are we talking about? Practice?
What are we talking
about? We're talking about practice. We always talking about practice one way or another. I want to circle back because you talked about experiencing some vision loss. Was that permanent? Do you still have that vision loss in one eye?
Yeah. I'm all blind in one eye.
Well, I have pretty bad eyesight, but I have eyesight in both eyes. It makes it way more impressive that you do what you do with some type of vision loss.
Well, thanks. I did say it so you could make me feel better about it.
Nice. Okay, well, I have a few questions about your work and your relationship with clients. It's clear that nature plays a significant role in your artwork, and I imagine the almost unlimited number of outdoor opportunities that Colorado offers is a giant source of inspiration for you. Camping, hiking, snowboarding. However, if you're like us, you're also inspired by other designers. What kind of inspiration and techniques have you pulled from different designers and illustrators?
What a perfect question. This is one of my favorites because then it gives me the opportunity to like shout out people that I really admire. The list is insane. I spend too much time on Instagram or the internet, but it's like all in a pursuit of, I am so deeply interested in art as a craft that I'm just obsessed at looking at what other people are doing. But to speak on like early days of getting started, I can like vividly think of these three artists that really honed in on like what I wanted to do. Derek Castle, if you're not familiar, write this shit down, look it up. Derek Castle, Haphazard Press, and a woman by the name of Black Man Studio. Those three people, I've followed since the beginning of me being a designer. Something about their style. They all worked in the apparel world, but the way they could strip down design into like one color. Obviously, screen printing, you got to like be aware of the amount of colors you're using. So to be able to get a detailed illustration in one color, it's like so much like energy in it. I was like, man, that's so crazy. Like, how can I like kind of mimic that style? So like learning that way, like seeing, and it wasn't even like they were posting educational stuff. They were just posting their work and I was making it educational for myself. I was learning from it. They weren't intending to be that, but I was like, you know, how are they using the color of the shirt to act as like line work for your drawing? So you're only printing one color. How can you use like shadow or halftones or whatever it ends up being to like really utilize the medium you're working in? This is all specific to like apparel design. Obviously, like if you're interested in something else, try to find people that are doing what you want to do and see how they do it. I never asked them a single question, nor did they give any advice. I just learned from them existing because I was so interested in how they were doing it. And obviously, we're not trying to copy people. So you want to take inspiration from that and then figure out how can you make it your own. And then that led into like finding newer designers. Like, again, I'm going to bring up Jason Craig. I guess we were talking about Jason earlier, but like seeing how he works and like a very different style from those three people I just mentioned, you know, talented illustrator, but also a mural artist. And then you go into a woman named Gemma O'Brien. She is an insane typographer and like mural artist, completely different than all their styles. And I'm like, okay, so how can I take little bits and pieces from all these people, tuck it away into my own version? And none of them are teaching me necessarily like technical things, nor did I seek that out. There are a lot of resources to learn like technical ways to use the tools, but that was never something I was interested in. I was like, I'll figure that part out on my own. Again, this is not good advice. I'm just saying what I did. You should for sure learn how to use the tools to the best of their ability. And there's some people that give such good advice on like Illustrator. I'm like, oh, here's how this tool works. It'll make your life 10 times easier. And I absolutely should do that. I don't, but you should. And Instagram in itself or whatever it is, Pinterest, find an artist that you really get down with and just like observe their work. And you can learn so much from just a photo. I learned different techniques from like their line weights to their color usage to how they're able to take a garment, incorporate that into their work. All this technical stuff that they didn't say it to me. I just looked at their stuff. I don't know if I'm expressing that in the best way, but those three people, I've never met them in real life. Most of them, I don't even know what they look like, but they influenced me as an artist to do what I'm doing now. And the list of shout outs could go on. I mean, there's so many crazy talented people. Just find people that are like in the world that you want to exist in and go from there. Don't copy people. Don't steal their work, but be inspired by their work. There's a line there. And I think that's a good way to just like to learn how to do things is just watch other people. Obviously, if you want to go to Skillshare and get an actual course, DKNG is another great example of like educational design tips of here's how you do this. And they're insane illustrators. I've learned great things from them. Tool tips and Illustrator of how to like use specific things. Very helpful. It just depends on like what kind of person you are and how you learn. I don't learn well like that. I learn by doing things on my own, figuring it out. So find that out, figure out what works best for you and just like look at shit is the short way to answer that.
I think you expressed yourself well. It's interesting because I don't think you have to be super technical and you don't have to know the tool inside and out. I mean, it really does depend on what you're doing, like what type of work you're trying to produce and what you're trying to achieve visually. But at the end of the day, like these are just tools, you know, learning how to use Illustrator and learning, you know, the keyboard shortcut for a gradient mesh or how to apply it. That's not going to turn you into a better illustrator or designer from a concept or conceptual point of view. It's not going to teach you how to all of a sudden solve problems better for a client you're working with. To push back on what you were saying earlier about, or what you're saying not being good advice, I think also is good advice because you can learn a lot from people just from being observant, not looking specifically for just tool tips and feature tutorials and things like that. Just listening to a conversation like this where you're hearing somebody tell their story and talk about their journey and the path that they're on, you can take so much value from something as simple as that if you're observant and you're looking for that value. Because most of the time, if you're looking for something, you're going to find a way to find it. You know, even if it's not the thing that person was intending to give you, you'll find a way to take and extract value from that. So yeah, it's bad advice, but at the same time, it's good advice. A lot of what we're saying today, I think, blends and straddles that line between like being great advice and being not good advice. It really depends on what you want to take away, as long as you're being observant. And I think that's sort of what you were leaning into, was just like, hey, like, go and find someone that you feel like you can learn from. And your example of line weight, I think, was perfect. That's the perfect thing you can pick up from another artist or designer and not just straight up rip off their work. Because now we're thinking smaller, more granular details. Mm-hmm. Let me tune in to the way they're doing it, not what they're doing. And then take the way they did it and then apply that to your own work in your own way. And I think that's a great example, is the line weight, because, you know, no one has line weight trademarked, you know, like not, right. Someone's not going to have a certain line weight copyrighted. So like, that's perfect. You know, the texture, the way people apply texture, the way people create shadows, the way people use a light source. I think those are all small technical ways to like take from other designers and illustrators without ripping off their work.
There's a fine line there, but I think it's I don't know. I just obsessively watch people, and I still do it now. I still am technically like learning, if that's what you want to call it. It's just, I admire art, and it makes me like feel good when I see, it doesn't have to be someone I know, but when I see someone like making cool shit, good for you. That's awesome. I mean, it's cooler when it is someone I know, because then I can like hype them up. You're doing awesome stuff, and tell people they're doing cool shit too. When you see cool stuff, just like share that. It feels good to know that people are getting something from what you're doing. So if you post a design and someone is like, whoa, this is really cool. I really like the colors you used here. Like, this was a cool way to do this. All that stuff is in a way educational, because you're like, oh, I've never really thought about that idea. And then like, huh, I could use that. Like you said, I try to zoom in on line weight, color palette, maybe like general layout, but I'm never like, I'm going to take the drawing you did and take that part. That's way too zoomed out. That's too high level. Like, now we're just copying. But you zoom in, you're like, oh, I really like the way they tapered that line there. Or I like how they like made this shadow right here. It really like helps add some contrast in the piece. That's like true inspiration, because you're like, all right, I'm looking at the contrast of their art. I'm not looking at the art itself. I'm looking at this very small piece. And now I can use that same technique in my drawing. That's something completely different. But I don't know, that's how I learn the best, and how I've always learned, and I'm still learning in that same way now. And my style has changed over the years pretty heavily because of that. Because I look at new stuff and I'm like, oh shit, that's... And when I see people make cool stuff, it makes me want to like get back to it, make more.
Last I knew, you were using a combination of Photoshop and Illustrator to create your illustrations. Is that still the process you use today? And if so, how do you split the work between those two applications for a typical project?
Currently, yes, probably 80% Photoshop, 20% Illustrator. Deep down, I really want to be just like 100% Illustrator. Application-wise, as far as like making merchandise, Illustrator is just kind of like a across the board, a better file format for manufacturers to use. Eventually, even though I use 80% Photoshop, 20% Illustrator, the end file, for the most part, they prefer to be Illustrator. No matter what I do over here in Photoshop, it needs to eventually become Illustrator. Not everyone, to a certain degree, everyone prefers that. And I always say I make the wireframe in Illustrator. So like, I do typography, I do like shapes, I get the bones in there. And then I take that over to Photoshop and I draw on top of that to give me some like structure and some guidance. And then at the end, I bring it back to Illustrator. And depending on the complexity of the design, I'll either use like a version of like ImageTrace within the software, or I have like a third party software that does like high level like vector tracing of my Photoshop file. Sometimes that's not enough. Then I would have to like break down my piece into like separate colors and ImageTrace that way, and then like recombine it, like Frankenstein it back together, which ends up being kind of a nuisance because it's never the same as it was in Photoshop. Even though technically I'm drawing to scale, it's high resolution enough, you could use a Photoshop file. It's just like, for whatever reason, for manufacturing, they all want Illustrator, even though it's not necessary. Some people just prefer that. That's how they work. So you kind of just got to like, to play the game, you got to do that stuff. So in theory, it would be better for me to just do 100% Illustrator. I learned in Photoshop. And again, I'm just too stubborn to learn a different way to do it.
Yeah, it can be hard to break those original habits, especially if you've been doing it that way or a certain way for so long, it takes time to sort of unwrite the way you do things. And then, of course, you know, you need to be willing to unwrite it to begin with, too. How often do you lose work because of Photoshop or Illustrator crashing? Is it easy for you to remember to save frequently, or do you still get caught off guard?
It's funny that you bring this up. So normally I'm like a stickler. Like while I'm drawing, I'm just Control S, Command S all day. Never a problem. And if Illustrator crashes, like typically Illustrator has like a pretty good backup system where it'll recover what you last saved at or whatever. Normally not an issue. I'm like pretty dialed in about that. But just last week, Illustrator crashed, gone, what I was working on. So I opened it back up. When I hit save, I don't know if it was on me or like a technical glitch, but I work through like Dropbox through the cloud. In theory, it should have everything backed up there as well. But whatever happened when I saved, it saved over what I did with this new version of the backup that it had. I don't know what happened, but it erased everything that I had done. It was like basically a nearly blank canvas that I had been working on for like 6 hours. So I had to just redo all that shit. So normally I'm like dialed into that stuff. Photoshop never crashes for me, but Illustrator is like once a week, that thing was just like, I'm timed out right now. I'm going to take a nap. But most of the time it doesn't cause issue. It has its own like backup software. It is annoying. So, you know, save that shit.
Yeah, you can still get caught. I'm pretty disciplined with saving. Do it too often, honestly. Like if there was a way for the file to degrade from the number of saves you made, my files would be absolute dog shit because I save so often that you would be surprised to ever lose work. But every now and then you're in the zone working for a couple of hours or some type of glitch happens and you like rewrite or save over something that should have been saved, you know, way sooner and you wouldn't have lost that. But 6 hours is rough. That's a lot of work to lose. I think the last time I lost a significant amount of work was for this podcast. I think it was Daniel Schwartz's interview. I lost about half of my editing and I had to go and re-edit like half of the episode because a lot of the times when I make cuts and separate audio in the timeline, you need to put a fade on the beginning and end of that clip to make sure it's not clipping audibly. And it's a way to mask and disguise that an edit was made. And if you've ever edited audio or video, then you sort of can understand this or resonate with this idea or this concept. But I had edited the entire back half of the episode, and there were a lot of moments where there were custom fades, where you manually put the fade on the beginning and the end of the clip. And then it's not automated, so they're all custom fades, and they're faded a different amount and in different areas. Well, I had all of the events for like half the interviews selected, and I hit the wrong keyboard shortcut. And then it put auto fades on the front and back of every single one of those audio events. It overwrote all of the custom fades I made. And it took me like 5 or 10 minutes to even realize that it had done it. Like it did it and I didn't even know. So eventually I went into the preferences for Studio One Pro, which is what I use to edit audio. And I sort of removed the keyboard shortcut from auto fades altogether so that hopefully it never happens again. But I just reverted to an older file to like start fresh because it had ruined all of those custom fades and basically replaced it with a fade that was automated, but wasn't good enough. And it was just one of those things, like it was a complete accident. I don't know how it happened, but I ended up losing like hours and hours of work that I had to basically redo.
We're just like, all right, I guess we're back into it. Let's start over.
Yeah, you got no choice, right? I'm going to beat myself up about it the least amount of time possible so that I can just get back to work and just start it fresh, use that energy to sort of recoup everything I lost, you know, or start working toward that. But yeah, that was the last time. And that would have been, it was only a couple episodes ago. It's like 3 or 4 episodes ago that that happened, but it hasn't happened often. That had nothing to do with me saving either. I was on top of saving. We're not losing it for that reason. It's like some other bullshit because now the entire creative suite is online and it's subscription based. And now all of a sudden it sucks compared to when it was CS2 and 3 on a physical disc. And they were super stable applications at that time. So we're in a completely different world. And if you didn't live in that world, yeah, you just have no point of reference, which is also good. You didn't have to pay $1,500 for a CD. Now you pay $3,000 for no CD because it's all subscription based.
Yeah, for an app that really, Adobe's wild, but I'm a sucker to the Adobe products. So here we are.
You're locked in. I think my next question is another one that people can relate to pretty easily. I've spoken to a few people on this podcast about designing within limitations or with restrictions and how it can help us do better work. How much direction from a client do you need to feel comfortable getting started? And how do you push back when a client says, do whatever you want?
The do whatever you want tagline to some people seems like that would be the best scenario, but it's at most times the worst option because do whatever you want encompasses a lot of things, which usually end up in just like wasting time back and forth. So the few times that that happens, like I said before, I don't have too many like forms or contracts or anything to fill out or sign, but I will like have a couple questions to ask to really get out of these people, like what I need from them. So if they just hit me with, oh, just make whatever you want, or they don't have a direction, like you have to push back on that because whatever you do round one for that type of person isn't going to be what they want. So you basically, that's just a wash. So instead of doing round one, I just go back with like, okay, here's three questions that you can answer for me that would help me get to a direction. And it's usually like, okay, can you list three objects that you would be interested in having in your design? Can you list like a style of design that you like or a color palette that you might be interested in? And this is all like vague, like high level. None of it has to be specific. Just push me in some direction. Be like, I like bears. I hate moose. Perfect. Then I won't draw that. All that stuff, they might not think to say it, but you'll do round one and then they have all these opinions. Well, where were these opinions before we got here? They have the opinion. They just don't know how to like verbalize it. So you're like, here's a couple quick questions. I don't like to send like this form that they had to fill out because then it like gives them extra work to do. And it can sometimes hold up the project. If you send them a 3-page questionnaire, they're like, oh, well, I don't want to do this. But it is necessary to like get the project going. So I just try to keep it light, ask a couple questions that at least get me in the right direction and go from there. And then usually there's still revisions, but at least I know like a general idea of what they want. I think early on freelancing, I didn't push back on clients at all because I felt like, you know, I didn't have the clout to like defend myself in a way. So I just kind of like did whatever they said, which I think a lot of people do starting out. You kind of like, well, I don't want to lose the job, so I'm just going to do whatever the client says. But I think more often they want guidance because in theory, you're like the expert that they're working with. So you should steer the car a bit and they're just a passenger. That's not always how it works, but you should take control in that scenario.
Taking control is great advice. What really gets me, and I hate to see this in students and just younger professionals in general, is when you fall into the trap of feeling like asking questions makes you look less like a professional or less like an expert. I'm from the camp, like it's the complete opposite for me. If someone comes to me and they have a million questions, I automatically assume they're being thoughtful, they care enough to come up with questions, they have questions, which is good because we can sort of clarify and I can give some feedback or maybe even direction in that case with a client. It makes me feel better when people have a lot of questions. Well, first off, they're brave enough to ask those questions, but they also genuinely need information from you to do their best work. So I hate when students fall into that trap of feeling like they look less professional or less like an expert because they're not asking questions and then they hold back from asking those questions. And I think that's how you can sort of spin your wheels way too long. You can waste a lot of time doing something that the client is never going to approve because they didn't have something to react to from the get-go.
I agree with that sentiment. I think it makes the client feel like you care. You're putting in effort. You came up with all these questions because you thought about their project instead of just being like, okay, I'll see you in a week with a first round. Or you're like, here's 10 questions that I thought of that I think would help the process. To me, that shows the client that you're like putting effort into this project and you want it to be like good for both of them.
My big takeaway from what you said is just to ask questions when you need to. Maybe you don't need to ask questions because they were squared away and they gave you exactly what you needed to get mm-hmm. started. But when you're in that moment where you're struggling to find a direction or you're struggling to generate ideas or you're worried they're not going to go for one of your ideas because they didn't give you enough starting information, then in that situation, you have to ask questions. You have to give yourself a chance to not spin your wheels and do work that isn't going to get approved. Earlier, I brought up your use and application of color, which I think is exceptional. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned this in a previous interview, but I have a red-green color deficiency. So I'm always on the lookout for color hacks or ways to create more effective color palettes. Can you walk us through where you like to sample color from and where you look for inspiration?
I didn't know that. Seems like that would make it difficult for you.
Yeah, it's a pain. Creative pain. Shout out Tyler Pate.
Shout out Tyler. The best illustrator in the world. Where I go for the color palette, I think now I have my go-tos kind of formed over the years. But early on, I still do. I go to this Instagram page called Topia Tones, and they just post like random color palettes. And the ones that I like, I just save them on Instagram. I'm like, okay, that's cool. I don't know what I'm going to use it for, but I'll just save it. Same thing with like if I see a piece of art, I don't even necessarily have to like the actual design, but if I like the way they comboed colors, I'm like, all right, let me save that. So I got like Pinterest boards. Pinterest is my go-to. That's where I get all my inspiration from. You can organize it, put it on there. Pinterest is top tier for gathering resources. So I have like a whole tab of just like color palettes that I like. And I scroll through it from time to time when I'm kind of stuck thinking of things. And obviously, I do a lot of nature, like mountainy stuff. So there's like a typical color palette that's supposed to work with that. But I'm like, how can I make that interesting? I'll take a color palette from one of those things I saved from Topia Tones or wherever I got it. I'll bring it into Photoshop and I'll kind of shift the saturation, shift the hues, shift whatever, the contrast. And you kind of start getting a difference in like value and start playing with that. I'll use that color palette while I'm drawing. And then as I'm drawing, I've looked at it long enough. I'm like, I actually don't like the way these two colors work together. So let me shift it in a different direction. It's just like a lot of messing around in real time with how it works. Obviously, you do that enough to where now I know these colors work really well together. I really like this combo. So you can kind of like pick from your past projects of things that you know have worked and use those. After 10 years of drawing shit, you can reference your own work. But I still, from time to time, I see cool color palette or like just unusual things where you're like, oh, I've never put purple and green together, or like pink and green, but like they made it work. So let me take that, shift it around a bit. So I'm not like directly ripping it off, but it just goes back to this pursuit of art is like something that I'm pretty deeply interested in. And I'm just looking at it all the time. I'm not necessarily looking at it with any intention in the moment. I'm just like, oh, that's a cool piece. Maybe I'll reference that 3 months from now when I'm drawing. Like, oh, remember that piece I saw that had really cool color value? Let me reference that, grab some colors. And it's really all just trial and error because that color combo could look really cool on that piece. And then you take those colors and you put them on what you're working on. And you're like, whatever that transfer is, it just doesn't work with what I'm doing. So then that's when you start picking your own. You're like, all right, let me shift the green to a little darker, a little brighter, whatever it is. So there's no like direct answer of like, here's the color palette I got it from. I took the exact thing. I put it on mine. It worked perfectly. It's all just like, you got to experiment with that stuff. And then eventually that experimental phase becomes 5 years of trial and error. And now you kind of have a set palette that you know works and you're comfortable with. And you kind of just like recycle that a bit.
I love how you dug into the context of what's in the design or the illustration and how that can make a difference, because a color palette may work brilliantly for one piece and then not work at all for another piece. And your follow up to that and saying that that's the perfect time to take that original color palette and then start shifting some of the values and the tones to sort of stay in the world of where that color palette originated from, but twist it, manipulate it in a way that's going to fit the context of where you're working on better. It's a great starting point and a great way to pivot once you realize, oh shit, this actually isn't going to work as well as I thought it was. It's great over here, but it doesn't work here for some reason. It feels off or it looks off. Let me figure out how I can make small adjustments to get it in a better spot. But having that starting point, that's what's really helpful for me with a true color deficiency. I need some help sometimes. Sometimes I just ask people, I'm like, hey, does this look good? I'm like, am I missing something that I should be seeing? This plays into life as well. So like traffic lights, I ask my partner all the time as we're like approaching an intersection, like, hey, is that yellow or is that red? So like there are some things in life that I struggle with. I need some context clues. What I do, you memorize the position of the lights on traffic lights. And that's how you know for sure what the color is. But if it's dark and you can't see what position the light is in, then you need some kind of context. I either need to ask Meg if she's with me. That's easy. Just like, hey, Meg, what color is that? Sometimes she will even do it, preemptively do it for me because she understands like in this situation, this environment, I'm going to like maybe question it. And then if there's no one riding with me, then I'm looking at traffic pattern. I'm looking at whether or not there is traffic crossing the intersection. Because if there's traffic, if there's cross traffic, then that's not a green light that I'm approaching because I see other cars going through the intersection. Or hopefully there's somebody in front of me that's going to hit the brakes. And I'm like, okay, obviously I'm going to slow down because they're hitting the brakes. So if you're not the first person approaching that intersection, then it's a lot easier to just use context clues in the environment to sort of figure out what that color is. If you're having trouble sort of distinguishing the colors from each other, the problem is there's not a red and a yellow and a green all on at the same time. So when you lose that point of reference, then it's harder to distinguish which color it actually is because I can't see the red next to the yellow next to the green to be like, oh, that's the red, that's the yellow, that's the green. It's easy then. But those are just wild. You know, like a little everyday life struggle.
There's this Instagram profile. I wish I remember the name of it, but they take basically the entire color wheel and they mix it into a circle in Photoshop. And then they grayscale it. So now you're just looking at the values of gray, basically white all the way to black. But then there's all these hues of gray in the middle that are technically color. You've just changed the color mode of your document. And then they use that and they'll use the color picker. And then they do their illustration based off of the values of gray. Because then you're just looking at light and dark. That's a good way for you to really get a grasp of highlights and shadows. And like if you're trying to draw in that way of having shading and really getting a feel for contrast. And then at the very end of their drawing, they turn the color mode back to like RGB or whatever. And it always looks so good, even though they basically just chose random colors. So it's like there's pinks with purple and yellow and blue all mixed together. And it's always so rad to see that process of like, that's like true art right there, where you're just drawing based off of like contrast and value. And you're not even thinking about color. It was a cool exercise that I've always kind of wanted to play around with because you're just looking at like light and dark. And obviously, if you work in that way, the colors tend to work out on their own. But obviously, that's more of a ethereal way of drawing.
I love it. That just makes me smile, dude, because like that is so, I don't know, it's so masterful. And to strip away the color, like this is just understanding design fundamentals at their best and putting them into practice and not really, it's like logo design. Creating the logo without color at all to make sure that it works in just black or a single color. If it's solid design from the get-go, then color's going to work unless you just right. choose really awful colors for that the context of that piece. Color's going to work because your design isn't relying on the color itself to be successful in terms of design fundamentals or, you know, contrast and value and things like that. That just makes me smile to know that people are doing that. And when you see it in action, this is like the mind-blown moment. You're like, how the fuck are they doing this? This is so brilliant. The approach makes so much sense.
Makes me feel like that person's so creative. I'm like, what am I doing? You're like, damn. It just makes me want to like elevate when I'm, yeah, or quit. Yeah.
Well, I made it all the way back to the beginning of your Instagram feed while I was digging through your work. And it took a while because there's a million t-shirt designs you've created. How have the compositions of your illustrations improved over the years?
Beautiful, beautiful question. I love this thing that I do exactly what you did. When I see someone that I really like, their art, who they are, I scroll all the way back to their beginning. Because I want to see, like, if we're going to talk about comparison for a second, I want to see what your day one looks like. Because that's going to look a lot different than whatever day you're on now. I think for me, changing in composition or changing in art style in general, that just comes with like practice of talking about practice again. I was really happy with the art style that I had at the very beginning of my Instagram timeline. But that was also like the level of skill that I had at that time. And it felt like I was maxing out what I could do and I was happy with it. Now, when I go back and look at that stuff, it seems very beginner, very remedial, which is fine. But that was just part of the journey. And whatever changes your art style, maybe like a different person inspires you or you just see a different way of doing something and that slowly changes over time. And I feel like if I scroll like halfway up my Instagram, you can kind of start to see that shift. And I think part of it was when you draw simple stuff, it makes it easier for other people to also draw the same simple stuff, which is fine. They're not necessarily copying you. It's just a similar style. And I'm not one to ever get bummed out if people like have similar stuff to me. I don't get bothered by that shit. It's just like, I think a matter of the industry, like you're going to make stuff that overlaps. And unless it's like a direct copy, we can all just move on. And I just noticed the style that I was drawing in, like there was a lot of people kind of drawing in that because it was just like a very stripped back version of trees or mountains or wildlife. And it was just easily done. So a lot of people did it, but people liked it. People liked that easy shit as far as like a consumer talking about like working in the resort apparel world. People liked the simple stuff that just said the name of the town you're in and a mountain with the sun. That's what the people bought. So that's what I was doing. And that kind of edited my art style. Then eventually I was like, okay, let me see if I can push myself as an artist, but also like make myself different from all the other stuff. I'm going to add more detail, add more line. How can I draw rocks in a different way? Looking at something that's so insignificant is like, can I create my own style of drawing a tree or drawing a rock? Or how do I shade? So I started messing with that, and that kind of grows into what you see now. And then like you think about composition of like, what are you drawing on? Obviously I draw on t-shirts. So you're like, this is going on a person's body, and everyone like you kind of like taper the design like a triangle. So you're heavy up top, kind of taper. You don't want like a big square on your chest. So you're like, how do I think about how this is going to sit on someone's body? How's it going to feel? If you're screen printing, you're like, you don't want to feel like a big sheet of plastic on you. So you're like, how can I adjust the composition to where there's like a bunch of negative space so the shirt can show through? All these little nuances to designing merch, I think, have deeply affected to how I make art, to the point where when I draw for not merch and not apparel, it feels weird. When I have like unlimited color palette, or no restrictions, you know, if it's going to be digitally printed or if it's not even, you know, it's just a digital piece of art. It feels weird to draw that way because I've been conditioned basically to draw for apparel printing, which is fine because that's what I do. But I think what you're drawing for plays into how you do it and how your composition lays out and how you use color and use shadows and use halftones, whatever it is. That has really developed to where the style that I'm in now, I'm like super comfortable in and happy with. And I don't know where I'll take it from here, but it's just been 6 years of drawing. Once you draw trees and mountains for 6 years, you're like, how can I make this interesting for myself too? Because you can only draw mountains so many different ways. And, you know, just trying to better myself as an artist, but also like offer better piece of artwork to the customer as well. And make something that I'm proud of. Because I think at the time, I was proud of that early stuff. And now I'm not really proud of that anymore for some reason. And I think a lot of people go through that where they're like, they look at their old work and they're like, damn, that's not great. It's not terrible, but it's not my best. You know, I'm better now. And, you know, it's just part of the process of learning.
Mm-hmm. That's a great breakdown. I can tell that you've analyzed your own work over time and you've gone back and looked at it and you've sort of spent time thinking about how it's improved. And you sort of brought up comparison earlier, and that's come up on the podcast before, and it's a dangerous thing to do unless you know how to do it healthy. So what I heard from what you said is that by scrolling all the way back down to the beginning of a feed and then looking at where they are now, you're not comparing yourself to them and what their work looks like today and what your work looks like today. It's almost like you're comparing your progress against their progress. And you have to go back to where they started, look at where they were, where they got to, and where they're at today to sort of look at the amount of progress and improvement they've experienced in whatever that time frame is. And then you compare that against your own progress because you're so different, right? You could have a completely different type of work, but you can still compare your journey to somebody else's in terms of the timeline and things like that. I think if you're doing that in a healthy way, it can be very helpful to just sort of tune in to what other people have going on and where they've been and how they've improved. But you still want to be careful. It takes some time of realizing that you're on a different path and a different journey to start comparing yourself to others in more healthy ways. But I do something very similar. Well, I'll go back and like, man, how long did it take this motherfucker to do this? Right? Because this is amazing. This is incredible. I'm very impressed. How long did it take them? Most of the time, I'm not even comparing myself. I'm just super interested in what it took and how they got there. So that's the real reason I'm looking to begin with. And then some like offshoot, that'll make me think about my own journey. I'm like, oh yeah, okay. So now I can look at my own work in a different way and sort of, you know, well, how much did I get done in a year? Okay, that's interesting. And now I'm not comparing it to anybody else. I'm sort of comparing myself to myself. just right. trying to understand, like, am I really experiencing growth? And if I am, where is that growth happening? Because I'm sort of interested in how well I'm improving and how much I am improving over time.
It's naive to just tell someone like, well, don't compare yourself at all, which it's not realistic. You're going to look at what other people are doing and you're going to feel some type of way about it. If you can somewhere in your mind get the idea of like, if your comparison can be motivation, if your comparison can be like educational for you, it's easy to go down the unhealthy route of like, I'm inadequate. I don't know what I'm doing. I should be farther along in my career. Like I do that all the time. I still do it. But then I also really work at trying to compare it in a way that is constructive to myself. You look at like the big names in the industry, like Lincoln Design Co. They just celebrated 10 years this year. I'm about 10 years into the industry as well. I'm obviously not on the level of Lincoln Design Co. They have a whole squad of people. That's just not the route I went down. I didn't want to start an agency. I wanted to work for myself and by myself. So I can't necessarily one-to-one compare because they built something different. They're a team of a bunch of people making awesome work. If I just compared myself to one person at Lincoln, one-to-one, then I'm probably doing all right. Because that person is probably still a very talented designer, illustrator, but they're probably more in line with what I've achieved. I think it's like trying to spin the comparison to where it like makes it constructive for you to where you can feel good or motivated to where like, okay, maybe you do compare yourself to another person and you're like, I'm not quite as far as them. And I'm going to use that as like a goalpost to achieve. Like we brought up Tyler Pate. He is an incredible illustrator. He does what I want to do, which is draw specifically in Illustrator only. His work is insane. I don't think I would ever get to that level of work, which is fine, but it damn sure am I motivated to try. We're just different people doing different things. He's just like really good at it. And I want to be really good at doing what I'm doing. But just to naively say, don't compare yourself is like, well, that's not helpful to anyone. It's because I'm going to, no matter what. Like I compare myself to Aaron Draplin. And I'm like, well, that's a losing battle. Everyone loves that dude. Do I think there are better designers than Aaron Draplin? Absolutely. But did he do a good job at like creating this brand for himself and like this personality? Sure. You can't compare yourself to that kind of stuff in that way because it's just a different person, a different time. He's got the personality, all this stuff. So it's like, I still get down on myself when I look at people and I'm like, man, am I as good as what I think I am? Am I living in a delusion where I think I'm like good at this and I'm not? That's not healthy.
I'm glad you brought up 10 years because you started Nowhere Land in 2016. So that means next year marks the 10th anniversary. What does that mean for you and how does it make you feel?
It's kind of weird to say out loud. I feel accomplished in a way, but I also feel like I'm ready to change it up a bit. Not in the fact that I'm done with art kind of thing, but like through those 10 years, I've also like tried to make Nowhere Land a little merch apparel brand as well and like trying to sell stuff. And that's been fun, but it's not been successful. The freelance part of Nowhere Land has always been the 90%, and the 10% is trying to make merch for myself and sell it. I mean, that's been the whole 10 years. I've really been trying to pursue that, and I think things have just changed. Like I said earlier when I was talking about the long vision, short steps, over the years, my goal was always to be to work for myself, and I accomplished that. And I think I did a decent job at being successful. I can pay the bills. I can support myself and my family, and I'm comfortable. And I think that in itself is an accomplishment, and I'm happy about that. But I think in the pursuit of that, I threw out another post that's just different than what I want to do now. I have different interests that aren't about like making merchandise and selling products. Like I'm always going to design. I'm always going to be a freelancer. But I think 10 years is just like this like milestone of like, wow, I've done it for a while. And obviously 10 years might not be a while for some people. And I'm thinking about mixing it up. Maybe it's like, you know, I'm not going to sell Nowhere Land products anymore. I'm going to take that away. It's run its course. It's had its time. And it's just no longer bringing me interest. Like, you know, you got these blocks of life and you only have so much time to fit all those blocks in your life. Sometimes you got to take one out and you just got to like come to the conclusion that like it's just done. And it's, you're not giving up. You're not failing. You're just moving on to something else. And I think 10 years is a good cap of like Nowhere Land for 10 years can now just be done. And then what's the next step? Obviously, freelance is going to stay. I think we kind of talked about when you mentioned at Crop, you were like into baking and that stuff. I had mentioned like I was super into coffee and I want to explore that world. I don't know what that looks like. Do I make a coffee brand and I can still like use my design expertise in the coffee world? I would love that route. I don't know what that is. It could be nothing. It probably will be nothing. I just want my mind to be focused on something else. I'm super proud of this. I don't know a better way to say that. I think now that I have two kids, and up until this point, me and art were just like synonymous. That's all I was. There was nothing more to me. My personality, what I did was just design, art. That's all I was. And I think now I'm trying to like separate that a bit, be more than just that. I want to be a dad. I want to be a fun parent. I just want to like do other shit. Oftentimes, we hit these milestones and we don't have time to like really celebrate it because we're on to the next thing. So I think next year I want to cap it off, make a little book, kind of like Lincoln did, where it's just like greatest hits from the last 10 years. Really mark this milestone of 10 years of doing this and then see what comes after that. But there's part of me that's like a lot of people have helped me get to this point, and I feel like I owe it to them to like continue doing this for some reason. Not that they put any pressure on me, but I put that pressure on myself that you don't do 10 years of working for yourself without any help, even though it's technically just me. Like there's support along the way. Like it's whether it's family, your partner, your friends, clients, there's no way to get here without help from people. And I think depending on your personality, like that just makes it feel like I owe them something. You know, I owe them to continue. I owe them to like do a good job. But I also like have other interests and aspirations, and I don't know what's after 10 years.
Well, it sounds exciting. It sounds like maybe you're coming to terms with the idea that you can let go of that pressure of feeling like you need to continue just for the sake of others and their support of your work over the last 10 years. But Brooks, you are more than your art. That's what I'll say.
Thanks, Joseph.
And also, hey, I'm down for some ritual coffee. I might even bring some pastries and sell them out of the pastry cabinet.
That's a deep cut right there.
Man, I see you, Brooks. You used the word proud, and I think that's the perfect way to describe how you feel about what you've done. And 10-year mark, I think it's a great milestone to reach. A lot of people don't get there, but it's also how you got there. I think that journey is what really matters. And I think you should celebrate it, man. And now that you've said there's going to be like a 10-year best of book, I think you have to do it now because you just committed to it.
Said it out loud. Has to happen.
If you say you're going to do it, then do it.
All right. Well, next year is coming. Yeah.
All right. To wrap up our conversation, please highlight and promote anything you'd like and let us know where we can stay up to date with your work.
Pretty much just on Instagram is really the only place right now. My website's kind of in a under construction mode. So everything that I'm doing is on Instagram, Nowhere Land Supply. And that's where I post all the goodies and 1,000 more t-shirt designs.
Perfect. Brooks, we're all big fans of your work. And thanks for doing this. It's great to get to know you better. And we should definitely meet up soon because we're only an hour apart.
We should. Can't believe we've only met each other in another state, even though are only an hour apart. There's a whole mob of Colorado designers that we got to get together and hang.
Yeah. All right. To everyone listening, follow Brooks on Instagram at Nowhere Land Supply so you know exactly when and where his next t-shirt will be available because he's all over the place. Nature bags, Into the AM, shirts on tap. As always, thanks for tuning in and I hope you found some value in this episode. Cheers, y'all. Students of Design is an independent podcast created by me, Joseph Israel Raul Bullard. Please subscribe and share this episode if you found it valuable. And if there's a burning question you want to hear answered on the podcast, you can email it to studentsofdesignpod@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and I hope to catch you in the next episode. Peace.